Welcome back to the Clear Voice podcast, the podcast that talks to accomplished women about how they found their voices and are using them for change, with me, your host, Florence Bavananden. It's been a while since we last spoke. Not much has changed. We're still semi-locked down. London's just gone into tier two. But a few weeks ago, I spoke to Autumn Rowe. She was in Norway and I was in London. Autumn is a singer, songwriter, producer, and DJ from New York. She wrote the anthem Happiness, which when you go and listen to it after this podcast, you'll be like, yeah, I know that. In addition to so many other songs, she's written with Dua Lipa, Ava Max, Jack Jones, MK, Avicii, Deadmau5, Leona Lewis, Fifth Harmony. The list just goes on. She's also a celebrated vocal coach and appeared on season 2 of The X Factor and was the only coach on America's Got Talent for 5 years. In 2020, Autumn has begun to use her platform for activism and she wrote a song called We Are with John Baptiste, which was chosen to be a part of the Mask Up America campaign to help fuel the Black Lives Matter movement. We discussed finding yourself, finding your identity, and finding your voice, both in work and in your personal life, for the issues that matter to you. You'll hear it wasn't always plain sailing for Autumn. And although you may look at her now and think, wow, she is so successful, like anyone, it was a journey to get there. So let's get into it. Welcome, Autumn. It's so lovely to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
You are obviously the biggest Carole Baskin fan in the world.
Oh my gosh. Is she still on Dancing with the Stars? I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't, but I feel like that's definitely something I will check out immediately after finishing this recording.
Me too, sadly.
And so tell us a little bit about yourself. What do you do? What's your situation?
So my name's Autumn Rowe, and I do a few things. I'm a songwriter, primarily. I'm also a vocal coach. I coached America's Got Talent and The X Factor for 6 years. I'm a DJ. I'm a producer. I'm a mentor. I'm a bit of an activist. And I'm a woman.
Amazing. It's so many different identities in one, and isn't that the sort of real creative's life, is that we have so many different facets to our character and often actually to our professional lives as well.
Yes, absolutely.
And so tell me a little bit about your sort of journey, your finding your voice, because you're using it professionally. You're also helping other people find their voices and use them professionally. And then generally you're also, as you say, like a woman and an activist.
All right, how much time we got? Okay, so I'll try to wrap it up. So I started when I was about 16 on my journey in music. I went to high school in Times Square, and I got my first internship for Island Black Music, and I was also in about 4 choirs at the same time. So I would go to school, and then after school, just bounce around from choir to choir and my internship. So I had a pretty busy school life. My goal, though, was to kind of just get my foot in the door in the industry in high school, especially being at such a great location. So I started getting artists to perform at my school that were signed to A&M Records and Island Records, and kind of just slowly making relationships. My job at the record company was in promotions, so I basically just handed vinyl to DJs and had a long list of DJs that we needed to service, and I would give them records. I had no idea many years from then I would end up being a DJ myself. Because I kind of always, I don't know, sadly thought that was like more of a masculine thing to do. I just didn't see many women doing that kind of thing back then. So from that choir, I met a couple other girls and we started a girl group. We were in a girl group for maybe 4 years. We finally got some kind of traction and got a deal offer and we broke up. That's how it goes. And 9/11 happened. I'm now about 20 years old. or something like that. And I'm working at a hardware store doing account receivables. I actually thought 9/11 was a storytelling thing on the radio. I had no idea that it was actually happening. I was like, this is a weird story on the radio. Like, what? Why do they keep saying about like the planes crashing? What kind of station is this? And then my boss came in and was like, the World Trade Center has been hit. You need to find a way to get home. And I just, anyway, so that was horrible. And I left that job. I think I was laid off shortly after, like a lot of things just kind of didn't survive. And I ended up getting a job as an after school teacher for the kids who went to school at Ground Zero. And I was the vocal teacher. So now I'm 21 years old and I'm teaching kids who are just 3-4 years younger than myself. And it was my first time kind of in that position. But my job there was to help the kids and in a kind of like therapeutic way, as best as I could, help them use their voice and find their voice with singing and art to express themselves, because they've all been through incredibly traumatic experience. So I did the best I could, and I created, like, you know, songs we could sing and different activities, and just tried to make it a really positive environment. From that, I met another teacher and we started a band. And I was then in that band for like 5 or 6 years.
Wow.
As a lead singer. And that's pretty much where I learned to write. When I was in a girl group, I actually wasn't allowed to write. And I didn't feel like I had much of a voice, to be honest. I kind of was just given songs by another writer.
And was that from the label or was that from your bandmates?
From our management and the production company we were signed to. Granted, I was not a great writer, but now that I am a professional writer, I see the value in asking artists what they have to say, even if they're new writers, and trying to pull out a good story out of them. And that I didn't have that privilege back then. I just thought a writer just writes a song and you perform it. I had no idea like you could do what I do now. Because I write with a lot of artists who have never been in the studio in their first session ever. And we get songs out, you know, and sometimes those songs are their first single and it's their first time ever in the studio. So unfortunately, I didn't know that back then. So I didn't have a voice and I was singing songs that were cool, but I didn't necessarily have any attachment to. So through my band, I started to find my voice and perform songs that I was writing, all about things I enjoyed or wanted to express. And we worked with a producer named Swiss Beats for quite a few years, and he was like our mentor and guiding us. And I continued to write. And then I was now working at a shoe store as an assistant manager. I was also performing in my band, and I was in a wedding band on the weekends. I was super miserable and wanted to quit my job so I could do music full time.
But the hustle is real. So
the hustle is incredibly real. And I said, I need to write a song so I can quit my job. For me to get to the studio to write a song, the studio I had access to was a 2-hour commute each way.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah. I needed to get to the studio to build a catalog to get a publishing deal, you know? So basically in that year, I probably wrote and recorded like, I don't know, 100 songs or something crazy. And I mean like full demos, you know, with backgrounds and track and everything. And I got super duper sick from exhaustion, and I was really underweight for my size because I couldn't eat enough food with my schedule. It just was really, really unhealthy. And after a year of doing that, I got a week of paid vacation from my job. So I got a hotel room near the studio so I didn't have to commute back and forth. And I said, which I think it's so important, people have to say it out loud. Use your voice out loud. And I said, I need to write a song where I can quit my job this week. And I did. So on the third day, I wrote a song called Happiness, which was about my relationship at the time. and it was a very honest record. I wrote it to a instrumental, which was already out for like a couple years. It was called Brazil by then a DJ I had not even heard of called Deadmau5, who's now massive.
Yeah. My God.
Yeah. But this was 2009, you know, and wow. he was big, but he didn't quite get like MTV big yet. He was like huge underground as far as I could tell. So I wrote a pop R&B song over a EDM track, which at the time wasn't very common, especially a track that was that type of track. So I had to rearrange the track, chop it up. And the original track was close to 6 minutes. And I made it into a pop song, like found the elements. I'm like, oh, this part sounds like a bridge. This part sounds like a verse, whatever. And from the day I wrote it to the time it came out was maybe a year, year and a half. So I still had no idea like anything was going to happen. I didn't think it was a very good song. Anyway, fast track, the song gets into the hands of these incredible producers called Stargate, and they just did a joint venture with Jay-Z, a record company called Starrock, and they signed a young lady named Alexis Jordan, who they found on YouTube.
Wow.
Who was singing on America's Got Talent, who I had no idea years later I would end up coaching that show. So she recorded the song, and they were like, this is going to be her first single. We'd like to offer you a publishing deal. And I'm like, great. Does that mean I can quit my job? You know, I hate this job. And I did. So I quit the job. And then instantly my life changed. You know, it was so amazing because now all of a sudden I was going back and forth to the UK. And I then wrote her next two singles and then started working with a bunch of other acts like One Direction and Leona Lewis, Cher Lloyd. And that led to Simon Cowell's company, Psycho, interviewing me to coach the X Factor. So my first interview was for the UK X Factor. I actually did not get the job. They interviewed me again the next year to do the US show. And then I did get the job. And I ended up being the coach for Britney and one of LA Reid's contestants and one of Simon's, who are, we all know now as Fifth Harmony. So I had an incredibly high success rate, I will say, because
yes. I think basically anything you touch, success is the success rate that's going on here.
All five of my contestants are still doing music. Several of them have record deals or are on TV. They're all doing well. So and I still keep in contact with a lot of them. So basically that show though was very taxing on me emotionally and physically. It's a very demanding job to work on live TV. I can definitely compare it to what I've seen from like sports coaches and the intensity on the court or the field of the pressure. But the difference was the prize was $5 million and a record deal. The stakes are incredibly high, and I did not want to do it again. So I got asked to do season three, and I said no. But then I was offered America's Got Talent. And I initially said no to that as well. But then they were like, oh, it films in New York, and it's in the summer. So for me, that was really appealing because it was a chance to be in New York. At this time, I was traveling like 6 to 8 months a year, it felt like, between L.A., and Europe and just bouncing. So it was nice to have an excuse to stay home for 2 months, to be honest, because I was paying for a place I was barely living in. So I took the job and it was a really fun experience. Also because a lot of those people, you really are in many ways helping them find themselves. And a lot of those singers have never performed like live before. So you're literally helping them find their voice in so many ways. It's like their first time. I had a contestant who it was his first time ever on a plane. You know, he was in the military. Imagine your first performance ever being in front of the 17 million people.
I just can't, as a singer, that just rocks my world completely. I'm like, I just don't, I can't fathom it. that kind of pressure? But then equally, when it's your first time and you don't know anything else, is it like, oh, this is normal? And then when you're in a room of three people, you're like, what's all the fuss about?
They were definitely nervous, for sure. But some of them handled it so exceptionally well. And I definitely felt a lot of pressure to make it as comfortable and easy for them as possible and to make sure it just was very artist friendly. So yeah, basically did that for 6 years. I think my most successful artist on America's Got Talent was an artist named Grace Vanderwall. At the time we started working together, she was 12. We wrote an EP called Imperfectly Perfect together. At 13, she was headlining a Vegas show.
Wow.
Yeah.
God, that is so young.
So young. What was really, she's such a special young lady and she's such a good writer and she has so much to say, which is one, I worked with a lot of artists who are 12, 13, and I just really think people need to not discredit young people and pay attention to what they're saying because a lot of them have a lot on their mind. And so many people are like, oh, well, they're too young to write or they're too young to have anything to say. Like they don't know what their voice is yet. And I'm like, you're really mistaken. You're just not listening because a lot of these kids have a lot to say. And she's one of them. So that was so super exciting. And I think the most special thing that happened working with her was a song we wrote called Light the Sky was the 2016 Year of Search song for Google. So when the ball dropped, like they played the song on TV and with this incredibly touching video of all the most heartfelt, shocking moments or beautiful moments or painful moments from the year in this video. It's just, it makes you cry. And then I did one more year of the show after that, which I should have left before because I just really was kind of wanting to move on to other things already. But I think I just got a bit lost. So at the time of that last year, I was in DJ school because I knew I wanted to do other things. So I took a year and a half. I learned to DJ. And then I started DJing.
And when you say DJ school, is this like all the DJs Monday, 9 a.m.? It's like a classroom. And they're like, okay, here's a beat. Or is it more like learning on the job kind of casual situation?
No, it's a real school. It was an 8-course program.
Wow.
Where you go every week and you get homework. Everything between learning how to beat match by ear on turntables to then learning Ableton to learning marketing to learning how to do different mixes for different kinds of events. Different levels of DJing. It's a real school. And it started by Jam Master Jay from Run DMC. Before he passed. It's a very authentic school. So it was really amazing. Cool.
And in your class, were there many women?
Yes. There were many women in my class. There were it was quite a good distribution, I think, of men and women in DJ schools. It was quite cool. Yeah.
That's really cool. And I want to kind of swing all the way back to when you were 16, 17 and handing DJs vinyls and building these relationships, thinking like that's quite a big thing to do, to have to build relationships with complete strangers, give them something. And it can be quite a confronting situation with yourself. You've got a really big, like get into the right headspace to have a chat with a stranger. How did you deal with that?
Oh my God. Well, that was when I first realized how sexist the industry is because I was 16 and literally getting sexually harassed by men twice my age. You know, I was a super late bloomer. So I just like was growing boobs and I, you know, like didn't really know a lot of things. But I started to see how like guys were a bit weird to me and just a bit creepy, honestly. That's really what I remember most about that job.
Wow. And how did you deal with that? Because you're still having to, because I think this is a big thing about, you know, certain industries like the music industry, like hospitality sometimes, film industry. It's like there are these kind of dangers to women, but we still have to exist and we still have to be in the industry and make a success. And I think a lot of men don't realize that that's something that you go to work and that's something you're going to have to deal with, is how to deal with someone trying to sexually harass you.
Absolutely.
How did you deal with it?
Looking back, I think I brushed a lot of things off and I didn't really understand how some older men were flirting. I just assumed they were being friendly. But looking back, I'm like, you are such a loser, dude. Mm. You know, like, you're a complete moron. I just didn't really understand, honestly, because I wasn't thinking in that way yet. And unfortunately, like, the first few years of the industry, I was definitely taken advantage of by different men. And it took me a while to wise up in many ways, especially like back in those days, if you're pursuing an artist career, there was just a lot of pressure to be sexy and to like dress a certain way. And, you know, just so much pressure on how you look that you're putting all this energy out thinking, oh, this is how I need to look to be an artist. But men are seeing you and taking it as if you're just like throwing yourself at them a bit in some weird way.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then it was just different. Like, you couldn't Google people like you could now. And I didn't have mentors the way I mentor a lot of people now. Like, you know, now someone hits me up, they're like, oh, do you know so-and-so? Like a brand new artist or a brand new writer who's just trying to get in the industry. I'll be like, oh yeah, I know them. He's a piece of shit. You probably should just ignore him. You know, I'm like, I don't care if this guy doesn't ever work with me, whatever. Mm. But I didn't have that kind of person to do that for me. So I definitely was taken advantage of a few times, unfortunately, and dated the wrong guys. It was just a disaster for a while.
But, you know, you've obviously got through it and completely blossomed the other side.
Yeah, definitely. Fortunately, I'm okay. Yeah, because it could have gone so many other ways.
Mm-hmm. And then when you're working on America's Got Talent, you were saying that, you know, you're helping people find themselves, but then you're also in a new role and you're in a very high pressure situation. I think this is something that people, especially if you're going into sort of management role or a C-suite role, you're suddenly having to find your own feet and lead at the same time. How did you find that, especially in such a pressurized TV show environment?
I think the best way for me to do that was just to always do what's in the best interest of the artist. So, you know, every situation is completely different, and looking at them and their story, what they've been through, what they can handle, what they can't handle, and kind of just being that barrier of, okay, this is going to be too much for them, or this is enough, or they can go this far. And that goes for everything, like musically, you know, doing my best to make sure the songs that they sing make sense for them and have the right integrity for them and match their message as a person. You know, it's very easy to sing something that just sounds nice, but it doesn't match your story. Mm-hmm. So that's a really big part of it. It's just finding those right songs that match where you are in your life at the moment. And also helping the artist see themselves for where they are at that moment and say, like, does this song, do these lyrics match your story right now? Does this feel good for you to sing? Do you feel like you're saying who you are in a way that the world's going to connect with you when you perform this? Because this is what makes you special as a person. So, yeah.
I totally agree with all of the sentiment there as well. I think so many times, especially with social media and pressure to be something else, we're always trying to be something that we think other people want us to be, which it just never works. It's so removed. It's not powerful. It's not something anyone can connect to. But if we're just like, this is me, this is where I am, this is my story, suddenly there's an actual emotional connection that can happen.
Absolutely. Being yourself is super underrated.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. And so, kind of taking a little shimmy now, when was a time where you felt like you really didn't have a voice?
I feel like when I was starting out in the industry, I didn't have a voice. You know, I wasn't singing songs, I was writing. I felt like men were seeing me way more sexual than I was. I just felt like I was a bit of a puppet. Mm-hmm. And I didn't speak up for a lot of things. I don't think I had the confidence that I needed. And it was a really hard time to be in that position. I think when I transitioned into writing, you know, being a writer is a storyteller, my confidence grew a lot. And then I started speaking up for tons of things. And I just changed the way I thought. The way I dress, everything is just very different now. I don't dress to get someone's attention or to please anyone. I just do what I want to do in every aspect, really.
What do you think it was about writing that helped you to get there?
I think the most empowering thing for me about being a writer is that I'm only judged on my brain, not on what I look like, not on how I dress. It's nothing superficial about being a writer. It's either the words and the melody connect and make sense or they don't, but that's it, you know? And I think for a woman to be just judged on my brain and to be seen as intelligent and smart or talented or whatever is incredibly empowering because that's forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And it's an equal playing field as well.
Exactly. When a woman realizes her worth and how valuable she really is.
Yeah.
And it's so, so much bigger and so much more beautiful than skin deep. I feel like her star really rises.
Absolutely. I totally, totally agree with that. And when, so, you know, you've had this journey of not feeling like you had a voice, singing other people's songs that didn't connect with you, finding it and being more confident and writing for other people and telling stories. And was there a moment where you like, I found it. This is my voice. This is me.
You know, I think my voice has changed a lot over the years. It's kind of a weird one because as a writer, I write many genres. So I can write country, I can write pop, I can write dance, I can write R&B, I can write soul, hip hop. So I will adapt my voice to what's needed in the room many times. But this year, this year has been a very difficult year. And I felt like I had to, my voice changed and it became a lot louder. And it became a lot louder because it had to. Many situations I'm in, for many reasons, I'm the only person of color. And I'm many times the only woman. Because of that, I feel like a social responsibility to speak up. And that's because I might be the only person like me that this person knows who's following me on social media. Mm-hmm. And I'm aware of that because I'll look at their other Facebook friends or their other Instagram friends. And I'm like, wow, I'm the only person like me that this person knows close enough to invite them in their home. I'm someone they respect. So if I'm raising an issue that's important to me, there's a good chance this is the first time this person's going to take this issue seriously. And that causes me to speak up even when I don't feel like it, even when I'm tired and I don't want to, because unfortunately, this might be my only chance to slightly change the world, you know? So I'm constantly just in this position and it does work. It really, really does work. And I've gotten messages from people saying I'm listening.
Amazing.
And it's been beautiful. Yeah.
That's really good. I'm so pleased. But also what a burden for you. You know, it shouldn't fall on you because you're the only person of color they know or you're the only woman they know. You know, it should also be the men that they know, the white people that they know who are also having their conversations with them. You know, it's not for us as women or you as a person of color to change the world for us as like oppressed or minority groups. You know, it's for everyone. But I'm so glad that you're, you know, making way and finding power from changing those minds and hopefully that they go and speak about it as well.
Yeah, I hope they do. And, you know, it's unfortunate. A lot of people just hang out with the people similar to them.
Yeah.
And it could be because they are from the same place or they look alike or whatever. But there's not that many social groups that are super diverse. When you look at friend groups, right? Just look at groups of pictures like, oh, this I'm had a night out. Very often it's like everyone kind of looks the same. My social group does not. It's everyone. it's not only multiracial, it's multicultural. Like my friend group is from so many countries and all kinds of gay, straight, whatever. It's just, but the common thing we have is being like really open-minded, you know, and just kind of having similar interests as opposed to being similar.
Wow. Yeah. Really good distinction there.
Yeah. You know, being similar isn't necessarily enough. I like to connect with people on things much bigger than that. I would like for more people to kind of go outside of their comfort friend bubble and connect with people that they maybe think, oh, we probably don't have anything in common, but you probably do.
Yeah, because we're all humans. We're all living this life on this earth. We all have shared, I mean, especially now, we all have a shared experience of like living through a pandemic.
Absolutely. Like I'm from the South Bronx originally. And for me to have friends in like so many different countries is crazy, you know, but we have so much in common. You really do.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you know, I'm from British countryside. I grew up somewhere where there were no people of color at all. I went to an international school, but it was still, you know, kind of quite polarized groups with some integration. But now, you know, I live in London and my husband, his family are from Sri Lanka and Trinidad, and my friends are from all different places, all different countries, culture. And I'm so grateful for the rich life that I lead now. Like we can learn so much from having a variety of friendships with a variety of people and add so much to our lives, you know, and also I think actually, personally speaking, the pandemic has been a real, I want to say blessing in that sense, because I have like one of my friends is Spanish, but she was living in South Africa and we still maintain contact through this weird time and we actually grew closer because of that, you know. So I think that we're living in this sort of real global village now, and technology and the sort of shift online is really facilitating friendships, even long distance friendships, much better than before.
Yeah, it is. It's really, the pandemic has shown us how connected we are and how small the world is. The fires in California, you know, the smoke spread to Europe last week.
Wow, I did not know that.
Yes, I think it spread to the UK.
Obviously, I was not looking out the window that day.
But I mean, how insane is that? Like, that just shows us how small the world is, and we're so connected. And whatever you do affects so many other people, even though it doesn't look like it, it really does. I just wish more people would see that and would. A really incredible man, one of the smartest men I've ever met in my life, said to me one day, like, you have to treat the world as if it's your child, you know? And if the world was your child, would you still do the things you're doing now? I have to say that answer would be no to a lot of things happening right now with the way we are abusing and taking advantage and not being kind to each other, the environment and animals and just everything. I can go off on that tangent forever, but yeah.
But you're totally right, you know, and I think also what you're saying about people being connected and using your connection and your influence within your circle of friends. I think when you are friends with people, it's easy to think that, oh, we're friends because we get on and we have exactly the same values. And then when they show a value that you're like, whoa, okay, we think very differently about this, and it's kind of making me want to not be friends with you now.
Yeah.
But as you say, actually using that sort of position of, okay, we obviously get on and we share some values, so let's have a conversation about this and then actually start to make progress and change minds.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So I feel like we've kind of covered it already, but the next question I always ask is how you're using your voice for change.
You know, how I'm using my voice for change is speaking out on social media. I also speak out a lot one-on-one with people. I've been doing that for years with just people I come in contact with who are clearly oblivious to people that are not as privileged as them. And just having like very, very long talks about it. There was one gentleman I had a 6 month long discussion with about.
Wow, that is dedication and patience.
You know, it really was. And it was about systematic racism and stuff. And this was like 5-6 years ago or so. And after the 6 months, he just still wanted to deny that it existed. So I actually cut ties with him because I said, you know, I don't know how much more proof I can show you. I've spent 6 months. Like, I feel like I've done a lot. And I cut ties with him. And then 2-3 years later, he messaged me like acknowledging he was wrong.
Wow. I would love to know what made that change. Like, what was that moment for him that he was like, oh, when Autumn was talking to me for 6 months, 3 years ago, actually, she was right. Like, what was that moment?
I think as the news progressed and things started becoming more and more to light, he just probably finally like started paying attention. So I'm like, you know, good for you. I'm happy that you're starting to see things differently. But, you know, I still don't necessarily want to be his friend, but... Yeah.
That also does go to show that even though we might feel like we're not having an impact in those conversations and that someone is just, no, that actually, even years later, you are always chipping away at them.
Absolutely.
And years later, you know, like, I'm sure that if that news had happened and he hadn't had those conversations with you, he might have reacted in the same way that he did initially with you and been like, no, it's not a real thing. But because you'd had really invested that time, it clicked.
Yes. I've done it with a lot of people. And I think everyone I've done it to, it's clicked at some point.
Yeah.
And I've talked to friends about it and they're like, I don't have the energy for it. I'm like, you know what? Just plant the seed.
Yeah.
And walk away. But do it in a way that's not attacking them. Mm. Do it in a way that's kind. And do it in a way that do it when you're not angry.
Yeah. Key one.
And just walk away. Yeah. Don't be angry and then just walk away. If they still don't understand. And then it might take 10 years, it might take 20 years, it might take 1 year. I don't know. But I think if they're a good enough person that you were initially friends with them, they're going to have a moment where they realize, you know, what's going on. And then the other way I use my voice is through my music, through writing. I co-wrote a song called We Are earlier this year, was released. And that song is very special to me. It's by an incredible artist named John Batiste. And that song ended up leading one of the Black Lives Matter marches. It was called the We Are musical protest. And it's also one of the songs for the Mask Up America campaign with Governor Cuomo. And it's just a really beautiful song. It's We Are the Golden Ones, We Are the Chosen Ones is the chorus. And it's just about being awesome, being yourself and rising above it all. And just writing as much music as I can like that and looking to work with artists who also want to use their voice in that way is one of my passions, and not easy to find those artists, to be honest. Mm. So I'm definitely looking to collaborate with more of them. But yeah, sometimes, you know, you just use your voice also by just being in rooms that weren't made for you.
Wow. Yeah.
And that's also another massive way to use your voice, is just to occupy spaces that, you know, were normally made for men. And now all of a sudden you're there.
Exactly. And just your presence.
Exactly.
Amazing. And who are the women that inspire you?
There are so many women who inspire me, honestly. I have to mention Ruth Bader because I'm just so heartbroken this week, honestly.
Yeah.
For me, if I'm doing something that I feel like I'm fighting for something. I had so many women before me to model what I'm doing after.
Yeah.
But they were the blueprint.
Yeah.
So to have so much guts and to do what they've done when no one before them has done it, it's just astounding to me.
Yeah, and to make such huge progress as well and change the world. And she's a real, like, she is also that blueprint for being rational and chipping away and not being angry and just having those conversations.
Absolutely. I love her. I love Nancy Pelosi. I love Michelle Obama. Ugh. I love Beyonce.
Just all the best ladies.
Yes, I just love them.
Amazing. Oh, Autumn, it's been such a joy to speak to you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Clear Voice podcast. Join me next week when I'm speaking to Marta Salcedo, who is a movement coach who is revolutionizing the world of personal training, combining it with coaching. We discuss really what it takes to succeed, finding your voice when you're in a new place, speaking a new language, and essentially being a new person. How Marta went through all of that and how she's come out the other side stronger and more successful. I'll see you then.